Thank you. Thank you, man, so much. I appreciate it. I don't know how you work here. I really, it's a terrible place to live.
Take care of yourself.
Hello, everybody. This is Again with This, episode 126. Let's watch Grant's show in True Blue. And now, here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
Welcome back, Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for your patronage. We really appreciate it so much that we're heading back once again into the maw of YouTube, this time to watch True Blue. No, not the Madonna video, alas. True Blue was also a cop show that ran as a mid-season replacement-ish right around the turn of the year of 1989 and 1990. This is a crap ton of, hey, it's that Law and Order judge slash detective in another precinct who is giving our heroes some red herring shit in the second act, guys. There's, hey, it's that wacky lady Annie Golden who I just saw taking Cliff Clavin's virginity on Cheers, and all of a sudden I'm not feeling so good. Super soap guy John Bolger, you've seen him in a gazillion things. Nestor Serrano, future Sopranos hotshot director Timothy Van Patten, Allie the Profiler Walker, who in a like timeline tesseract could have played Elizabeth Holmes with that voice.
Yeah, good call.
And of course, Grant Cho as the rookie on the squad. Creator David J. Kinghorn stopped working in TV in the late 90s, and I was like, So I Googled around, and the last evidence I saw of his existence was an online database of Wyoming licensed gun dealers. He and a Lynn Kinghorn own D&L Guns in Casper, Wyoming, and we wish them good luck and much gun safety with their Type 01 license that allows them to buy, sell, and repair firearms.
Okay.
The more you know. All right, let's get into a plot summary, even though it's a cop procedural and there's, you know, not a lot new here. Tara, you characterized True Blue when we were talking about this earlier this week as the 911 of its day. I would call it more like a third watch, but I only watched the second thing and not the first thing. Do you want to talk a little bit more about its 911-iness?
Yeah, 911, I think, sidesteps a lot of the pitfalls of cop shows, especially in our current day, by not having like continuing crime storylines. Really, it's less about, it's just incident after incident, really.
Right.
It's
responding.
Yes.
Right.
They're emergency response shows, this, both of these and Third Watch. And so it avoids a lot of the, you know, the dicier stuff that we tend to be more aware of, you know, in the past, let's say 10 years that cop shows do.
Right.
So it makes it less of a, you feel less compromised watching shows like this, I'd say.
Yeah, that's a good point. This, you know, the copaganda is less. There's some like trying to be funny bits that are worse in a show like this, in my experience. Mm-hmm. But this aired from December 1989 to February 1990. Ooh. I was like waiting to get into college slash trying to get it in. And I have no memory of this, but this, along with the show that apparently was called H-E-L-P, were, per Total Television, both airing at around this time, both similarly short-lived and focusing on NYPD and shot on location, which you can definitely tell this is. I think some of it's B-roll, but they're here. And this is also around the time Law and Order was being born. So this is sort of interesting as a like side note to look at similar-ish ideas in TV that all happen at the same time and which ones kind of die on the vine and which ones grow and continue on, and Law and Order still rampaging through the copaganda landscape as we speak. Yeah. After taking both these shows lunch money, I guess. but it was not that common for New York shows to shoot here back then. Now it's pretty common. There's like campers on my block pretty often, even though like it's just Bay Ridge, who cares? In any case, this is a pretty standard procedural in this 911 third watch vein in that you have three or four main calls, so to say, per episode, and then you have B and C plots. The episode C plot, I would say, is that Officer Allie Walker is boning a married colleague or is about to start. Her partner and other squad mates do not approve and want her to be careful. I think also because they're all boys, they're jealous. She and her partner, Bobby, argue about it in the radio car while Proby Grant Show makes Mom and Dad Are Fighting and I Hate It ick faces in the backseat. It's exactly as retrograde and not that funny as you'd expect from a 1989 property. And it's not super interesting, although at least Allie Walker gets to be like, you know what? I can make my own decision. Stop treating me like I'm your 12-year-old sister. Mm-hmm. Anything else on this?
No, that's it in a nutshell. I also was like kind of grossed out by where it started and was satisfied by where it ended.
Yeah, same. The B plot. Oh, God. All right, let's just get it over with. It is a bullshittily maudlin series of monologues about the fate of crack babies. The plot itself features an older officer who goes to the NICU to visit them every day. One in particular that he is bonded with is dying and then ends up dying, and the rest of the squad turns up in full dress at a cemetery that I am pretty sure is not Greenwood. That's all I have to add to that. to support Officer Mike in his pathetic attendance of little John Doe's burial. This was like just a constant received wisdom thing that you had to wade through in procedurals of this era. Take it away, Diner Lunch Exposition Team, clip two.
Well, Mike goes up to the hospital nursery almost every afternoon. He sits in his rocking chair and holds babies. Mostly abandoned babies, no human contact, that sort of thing. You know? Well, one of them is sick right now, a crack baby. It's about the fifth call he's made all day. Hey, so Mike, how's he doing?
He's hanging by a thread. You guys ought to see this little fella. You know, when he was born, he had so much crack cocaine in him. It was like he had a bunch of snakes inside. It was awful. He just couldn't hold still. Two strikes against him, he's only 3 weeks old.
I mean, this was like in every cop show. I don't think we even really noticed. We just assumed that law enforcement was right, that this was, quote, an epidemic. And I keep thinking back to that line from one of P.J. O'Rourke's books, which, like, I don't love quoting this guy, but this was a good line that he said 30 years ago. Like, whenever politicians say crack is, what they mean is N-words are.
Uh-huh.
So crack is destroying our inner cities. Yep. Crack is rending the fabric of America. Just replace crack is with. Mm-hmm. So that's like listening to this just so self-satisfied monologue from an old white Irish cop about this, you know, narrative model around not just cop heroics, but also drugs of abuse and crime and the uncut racist bullshit of it all. Anything to add to that?
No, I looked up an article that was like from the New York Times, which in its defense, like, does indict itself as being part of the media frenzy that turned this into a story that then got turned into TV. That, you know, there was never a crack baby epidemic. You know, yes, babies that are born premature, that where drugs are involved, have health issues and that affect them later in life, but like it was way overreported, and most of the received wisdom about it was based on a study of 23 infants, literally less than two dozen, and that you know, the problems that that babies have who have been exposed prenatally to alcohol are much greater than anything that happens supposedly with crack. So
and secondhand smoke as well. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And we'll link that in the show notes. And thank you for chasing that down. And even that is from like 2009.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, this is how we lived. And you see it in like very early Law and Orders. There's just like a lot of like, and anytime there's crack, there's like rap diegetically in the background. And it's like, once you see that this happens in every single fucking show between 82 and 97, you're just like, barf. Anyway. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to the goofy
stories. Yes, the episode title is Oldies But Goodies. Sort of ironic given what we've just been talking about, but it's kind of no wonder that the show did not survive, because the guiding conceit in this episode is that the city's oldies station, voiced here as it was in real life by Cousin Brucey, but under a fake call sign, because the oldies station was and remains WCBS-FM 101.1, and this was an NBC joint, so they had to change it.
That's funny.
Is taking us through a day in the Big Apple's life, or like a bunch of weekdays in the Big Apple's life, via the traffic chopper report. It's just like a runner. And the show really went to town on the soundtrack. And that last song, You Are My Precious Angel, that we'll get back to it, but it's been stuck in my head ever since. And it is such 50s treacle. I want to scream. Mm-hmm. Anyway. They may have just flat run out of money after this episode, and they had to like just do it with popsicle sticks, and nobody got makeup, because it's like a lot of pricey doo-wop in here. So, call number one. Pretty long, not as funny as it thinks. There's a hostage situation at a record and magazine store. I kept shopping the like racks behind the main action. I think it was Nestor Serrano. This print is very bad. Mm-hmm. Is obliged to dress up as Elvis Presley and sing Heartbreak Hotel so that an emotionally disturbed person will release his hostage from the record store and turn over his gun. Mission accomplished. It's not that great, but there's like some little moments in there of like camaraderie among the cops that like sometimes on these shows, everybody kind of, it feels like they just met. Mm-hmm. And this does feel like a lived in group at least. Mm-hmm. So that was good. But this segment was too long, I thought.
Yeah, I agree.
It is interesting though, like around that time, tabloid wise, like Elvis is Alive, crack pottery was like really at a pitch.
Yeah.
My senior year in high school. I don't get it. But anyway. Mm. The second call obliges Allie Walker and her partner Bobby to climb the Williamsburg Bridge, or maybe the Manhattan, don't at me, again, bad print, to rescue a, quote, jumper, which they do, having just been told, like, I think it's a jumper, I see someone up there, get out some binoculars, it is far, it is windy, you are complaining about it the whole fucking time. This could have been prevented. When they finally figure out what's going up on there, it's a couple trying to bone, which like, no. Like they would have been blown into the drink, and like, I don't care how dangerous you like it. No.
Well, they also have like, they're like, we're just here having a picnic. And like, they have a picnic basket. Like,
you
climbed up a ladder with one hand. One of you was carrying this basket of food. Like, at least if it was a backpack, it would be like, okay, fine. But yeah, it's...
No, it is a picnic basket.
It is. Yes, it's a wedding present picnic basket set. Like,
mm-hmm.
Totally.
Absolutely is. It's like, well, good thing they got those clever little straps for the plates and forks. And then, you know, Allie Walker's like, the green screen and I are over it. Cut. And that's what happens.
Totally.
The third call is a purse snatching, which is really not shot very well. The alleged perp snags an old lady's pocketbook, knocking her down. Proby Grant Show takes off in pursuit. They cut back and forth between these dudes. The perp is booking it, like zigzag fruit cart full on. And Grant is kind of jogging performatively so as not to mess up his hair.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Not to worry, though. The perpetrator takes a break in a doorway because he smokes cigarettes. Kids, that's bad. Mm-hmm. Proby Grant Show is able to haul him in and deliver a PSA without so much as breaking a sweat. Clip 3.
Put your hands behind your head. Lock your fingers. Now! Sweat him! I can't believe I got caught by a white. Don't you ever get tired?
Tired? We didn't do a mile, buddy.
Maybe 5 miles every morning. You just keep smoking these, all right?
You guys see my hat?
It's like little thing, like, I didn't see his hat. Did you see his hat? I was like, I'm glad they remember that because I did see his hat and, you know, continuity. Thank you.
I enjoyed that it's in Chinatown. It's a very picturesque place to shoot. If you're gonna do a show like this in New York, like, you might as well take advantage of like sets and locations that look interesting. And especially since it, you know, they end up in this alley, which there are not. I mean, you can look it up. Canonically, there are not a lot of alleys in New York for development reasons. But I remember when we were looking for an apartment in New York, one of the places that we looked at was like through a very skinny, like weird looking little alley, and then it opened up into this courtyard. And the place was like, it was way too dark, but it was also very picturesque. Like, unfortunately, I don't think I could live somewhere that was this bereft of windows, but it was a very cool location. And I appreciated the reminder in this scene, which also had Grant Show in it, looking hot.
I have been stuck in traffic near that alley many times. And I also enjoy, there's an alley called Jersey Street. Kind of doesn't go anywhere. Then it's time for the big showstopper. The little warning light in the traffic chopper from the first act goes off in the fourth, but this time it means it. The helicopter takes kind of no time at all to go down in the East River. The helicopter that killed Romano was much more melodramatic and dragged it out much longer. The pilot manages to swim free. His Mets hat drowned, rest in piss. But the reporter lady is trapped in there. Into the toxic brine go our heroes to haul her out and put her in one of those hanging tray situations where they pick up the astronauts from the little pod. Will she make it? She does, and dedicates Treacly, aforementioned earwig, "You Are My Special Angel," to the fine men and women of the emergency services unit. Yay/barf. But I must say, like, there was a lot of like, but for when it was, and for something that got canceled, I was expecting it to be slower and not as good. Like, it's not great, but it's pretty well paced. And it's, you know, it's okay. Just, it's from 1989, and there were a lot of like exciting blow 'em up, the floor is lava things that they can do on 911 that they just couldn't really do back then. And also, like, you could tell some shots were still stolen, even though they were allowed to be shooting.
Yeah.
They're like this B-roll of the FDR Drive, like, underpass. I was like, that looks like it's from the 60s, or like they took it from the French Connection or something. So, I mean, I wouldn't bother, but it is sort of interesting to look at in the context of Law and Order being about to start and then kind of set the tone for New York City cop shows.
Totally. There were a couple of moments where it's like, do we have to watch the entire drive from like the garage to the scene? Like, you know, tighten the shit up. But, and seeing Morton Downey Jr. alive and doing a cameo as like guy annoyed to have his cab pulled over on his way to the airport was like, wow, this is a real moment in time. But it did feel otherwise like very modern in those ways, like the Law and Order being a touchstone, like premiering the following year. It does have a lot of that kind of DNA, not only because it is New York and it looks like New York, but also just the, you know, you said lived in, that's a good way to put it, that the squad seems like they are people who have known each other for a time and are like talking like people in a normal, like, relatable human way. It doesn't seem as stagey as shows of this era did. And this feels like it was part of a turning point in like TV aesthetics that would continue in the 90s.
And there are, this didn't necessarily stick, but there are like all ages of cops. Like, there's, you know, probably not enough ladies, but there's like a, you know, the Southern guy and his canine dog. And then like, there's a whole like running gag, or it would be if it were funny, where, you know, his estranged wife works at that diner, and she wishes she got the dog in the divorce, but it belongs to the city. Da, 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 da. But like German yeah. Shepherds, I like those.
Yeah.
Okay, showtime. He's fine. He does not get much to do. We heard most of it. Indistinguishable from Jake. Looks good in a uniform. Again, it's not quite good enough a print, but he doesn't have his shirt off, alas. So I guess we didn't miss anything.
No, it's true. He's fine. Like, I don't totally buy him as the rookie. Like, he doesn't seem to be tentative enough, other than that one scene that you mentioned in the car.
Yeah,
he's too much of a star. Like, really, even the little they give him to do, he stands out in this ensemble.
Well, and you know, guys who look like that don't have to become cops.
No, they don't.
Actors, and that's what happens. So right. I would be interested, though. Maybe there is something like this on his resume, but I would be interested to see him playing like a bunk type, just like utterly confident cigar smoking murder police on a prestige show, because I bet he could kill that. But like the cadet, no way.
Mm-mm. Agree. But yeah, this was fun. This was a good vintage choice.
Hello, everybody. This is Again with This, episode 131. Let's watch Dina Meyer on Friends! And now here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
We're fun. We are fun. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, listeners. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for joining us today while I make Sarah watch another sitcom against her will. Today, we're here to talk about Friends Season 3, Episode 22, The One with the Screamer, which aired April 24th, 1997. It was written by Scott Silveri, future creator of the Canceled Too Soon Speechless, co-written by Shayna Goldberg-Meehan, also a producer on Speechless. The two of them also worked on Joey, a show that lasted much longer than you remember. It spanned 3 different calendar years. It's crazy to think about.
Wow.
That's true.
That is, yeah. Okay.
It was directed by Peter Boners, who started out as an actor, most notably on the Bob Newhart Show. Seems to be retired now, but he directed a ton of TV.
He worked hard and he worked long.
Well, that's the thrust of what I was getting at, Dave. I will get
the girth of his career.
I'll get to the most fun fact about him later. It is not Boner related. To situate listeners who are not as intimately familiar with Friends as I am, we are nearing the end of season 3. Ross and Rachel broke up in episode 16. This is episode 22, as I already said. They are still mostly hostile with each other, with some breaks to give the viewer hope they might still reconcile. Monica's dating Pete, a software billionaire played by Jon Favreau. He shows up in this episode for one line, so we know that they're still together, and he cashes a check, and God bless. Sarah, did you hope for more from your Dinner for Five friend?
No, not really.
Fair enough.
This was the era in which, like, I just feel like every single Friends episode was jam-packed with people that you're like, is that the president? Like, I don't know. It was a pleasure to see him, but it just made me miss Dinner for Five, which I just miss.
Yeah. It's true.
It's a good show.
He is the second most famous guest star in this episode. And the first is not Dina Meyer, but we'll get to it. So at this point in the season, Joey has been cast in a play called Boxing Day, where he immediately started beefing with his co-star Kate, played by our beloved Dina Meyer. Initially, she just dismisses Joey as a lightweight. She recognizes him from an infomercial he had done earlier in the season. But later, as they're working out their characters, they end up having hate sex, which makes Joey like her for real, which is why it is unfortunate that she is dating the show's director, Marshall, whom Sarah knows from 3 Law and Orders and 1 SVU. He's played by Reg Rogers. Currently on Broadway in Some Like It Hot, I believe. To help himself get his mind off Kate, Joey sleeps with someone else in the second episode of Kate's run. And who better than Kate's understudy in the play? Oh, Joey. So the one with the screamer is the end of Kate's arc. Spoiler. But before we get to her, let's talk about the C and B plot. The C plot we can dispense with very quickly. Phoebe is on hold for a million hours trying to get through to the company that made her shitty phone before her warranty runs out. At the end, she realizes it's not an 800 number. It's 801, which is just Utah. Wah, wah. Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah, it was fine. I could already sort of see that they were, it was already getting to the point where Phoebe was like no longer believable. Like she gets stuck in a sweater. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, there is a lot to that performance that keeps Phoebe from being unbearable.
Yes.
And, you know, good for you. And that's, you know, I'm glad that was the C plot and mm-hmm. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. On the sweater, though, I'm sure you noticed, as I did, that it is a J. Crew roll neck sweater, a garment that was very important sure to me at the time. Hers is mint green. She borrows it from Monica. I had it in red. I wore it out. But this is not about me. The B plot is, I think, more successful. When Ross says he is bringing a date to Joey's play, Rachel has to scramble and pretend Ross is not beating her at being single. So she meets Tommy, played by Ben Stiller. That's the most famous guest star in the episode. At sure the play, Rachel goes to the bathroom with Ross's date, Kaylin, some nobody. So Ross is present to witness this. Clip one.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. I think you may be in our seats.
No, I don't think so. Can we take a look at your ticket?
Sure.
Yep. Yeah, see, this says D13, and...
Oh, well, I thought that,
we were... huh? Yeah, well, that didn't really work out too well for it, did you, idiot? What are you, a moron, huh? It says D13, okay? Look, you're surrounded by even numbers. Does that give you some clue?
The usher told
her... Well, the usher must be right. What with all the training they go through? Get out! Here! Hey, man, you want the aisle?
No, I'm good.
So this is a Ben Stiller comic persona we will come to know. It was still a little bit fresher at this point, but he is like kind of just playing a version of himself. This was pre There's Something About Mary. So he was not as mm-hmm. famous as he would be very soon. But he had been in Reality Bites and Flirting with Disaster by this point. He had enough stature to have played himself on the Larry Sanders Show. So like it was assumed, okay, people know who this is. And he had directed The Cable Guy the year before this, playing the two Menendezes in that, or the two Menendez stand-ins, I guess. Discerning comedy right. fans would have known who he is. And that guy that he's yelling at, that's Peter Boners, our friend, in a little cameo. Love to see it.
So just hanging out in the aisle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know we're supposed to think that Ben Stiller's character is bad, and but, you know, he's kind of a hero for our seating times, in my opinion. Who true. Amongst us et al.
Yeah. So Ross tries to snitch on Tommy, but of course everyone just thinks that Ross has sour grapes about the breakup and doesn't take him seriously. Ross even drives his own date away because he is so obsessed with Tommy. And the next time Ross does accidentally get Tommy to snap, there are no witnesses again. Clip two.
No one believe me. I'm Mr. Funny to you. Mr. Funny.
Whoa!
Oh, sorry, Tommy.
What's in the cup, Ross? What is in the cup?
Okay, it's coffee.
Ice coffee? Tell me it's ice coffee.
It's hot.
Hot coffee! You idiot! You're gonna spill hot coffee all over me, huh? What are you, just a big, dumb, stupid, doofy idiot with a doofy idiot hairdo? Huh? Huh?
What's your favorite thing about summertime? Going to the beach when it stays light real late.
Yeah.
Hey!
Tommy! Say, what's your favorite thing about summer?
Ooh, I don't know. Probably the smell of freshly cut grass.
Oh, that's a good one.
My two favorite things about that clip are you can hear David Schwimmer as Ross, like, doing his own Ben Stiller impression at the beginning. Like, I'm just a joke. I'm Mr. Funny to you. Just, like, he's picking up his rhythms in that improv, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But even though Ross is in my bottom 50% of friends, the quiet knocking as he's trying to get everyone's attention while Tommy is yelling at him, which you can, like, barely hear in that clip, is it got me. I thought that was pretty funny.
I mean, I also know that we're supposed to think Ross sucks, and he does, I guess, but he's probably my favorite friend.
Oh.
Shrug.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I would not have guessed that.
I know we're not friends anymore. We had a good
run. No. I love to...
Bye, everyone.
I love to learn new facts about you this late into our acquaintance.
Who else is in your bottom half?
Oh, Monica and Chandler.
Okay.
I would say Rachel, Phoebe, and Joey are my favorites.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I would flip out. I would flip Rachel and Ross, but like I don't dislike Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really dislike Monica. Chandler is just tough to take. And it's worth noting that this is the Chandler Perry goateed weighs 20 pounds less than he should era. Mm-hmm. That's just like, it's not upsetting, but
no.
Like it's, it is a little upsetting to see him. He's clearly struggling already. So, yeah.
I agree. And those, by the way, would not have been my ratings at the time. This is they ebb and flow over time.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out Tommy can't just Michigan J Frog Ross forever. Clip 3.
Hey there, little fella. Mr. Fuzzy Man, how you doing? Oh. Ew. Oh. Ew. Gross. Idiot! Stupid little fuzzy yellow creature! Oh, look at me, I'm so cute, I'm a little chick who's disgusting! God, you're so stupid, how are you not yet extinct? Quick, 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 quick! What are you quacking about? Dumb Donald Dodo!
Step away from the duck.
I'm sorry, little Mr. Chickadee. Sorry, you had duty in my hand. Well, I guess we're not going out anymore. Man!
Okay. I would say, you know, Tommy's a character Ben Stiller wears pretty lightly, but it works as a one-off. His energy's so different from what the cast normally does. I think it's fun to see them rub up against his abrasiveness. It reminds me of... when Adam Goldberg guest starred as Chandler's roommate, Eddie, in the previous season. So, we're here to talk about Dina Meyer, but since we're here, what were your thoughts on Ben Stiller as we close him out?
I thought it was, there is a sort of, you know, Chandler-y energy usually to the friends that they can kind of be a little bit samey. Like Phoebe is whatever, this Daffy person who has maybe been out in the sun much too long in her life, but they're all kind of, and especially after a few seasons, like they are all kind of in the same rhythm, Monica being perhaps an exception, but to have that abrasiveness and especially to contrast it with Ross is, I don't know, it's fun. And Ben Stiller is on the point of laughing several times in that last clip, and I don't hate it. Like even he is sort of like, all right, this is my bit that I do and I'm gonna do it, but also I'm screaming at a tiny animal that fits in my hand, so
it's true.
And why haven't you gone extinct is something that I have now screamed at various companion animals several times since preparing this episode, so I enjoyed that. I thought it was fun.
So we mentioned the play already. Now we're in the A-plot. In this episode, it has its opening, followed by a cocktail party where Marshall, the director, decides to read the first review aloud without skimming it first. Oh, Marshall. Clip 4.
Boxing Day. The Lucille Hotel Theater. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. Ha! Joey Tribbiani gives an uneven performance. About Mr. Tribbiani is not the worst thing in this production.
Yes!
Kate Miller's awkward and mannered portrayal is laughable. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. Aha! Here it is. The direction by Marshall Townend is... Thank you. Boys and girls, you've ruined my life. Please, stuff your talentless faces with my mother's crab cakes. Excuse me!
So good.
Anyone mind if I save this?
I feel feel like Marshall's exit would have been a fine place to stop it, but Joey asking for it for his scrapbook because it says he's not the worst thing is so good.
The delivery, the despairing delivery of "excuse me" from this director who is wearing the 90s-est giant blazer that goes like down to his calves. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Such a wonderful performance in like 2 minutes of screen time. Love it.
Absolutely. So afterward, Joey and Kate commiserate. Clip 5.
Listen, drama critics, they're nothing but people who couldn't make it as actors. You know what you should do?
Become a drama critic.
I'm hurt! A plague of both your houses.
By the way, he dumped me tonight after he read my review. Oh,
classy.
Yep. I sure know how to pick him, huh? You know, I gave up a part on the soap for this.
Wow. Yeah, I gave up a job, too.
Really? What?
Decline cats. Hey, tell you what. Let me walk you home. We'll stop by every newsstand and burn every copy of their Times and the Post.
And why the Post?
Oh, you didn't see the Post?
No, you?
No, why?
So... That's
gorgeous.
That's the actual rap on Marshall. God bless him. So they, Joey and Kate, continue commiserating back at her place when she has had quite a few clip six.
You really think these newspapers are just jealous of me?
Oh, absolutely. You're talented and you're good looking.
Oh, you're sweet and cute.
I know. That's why they trashed me.
They kiss.
Well, wait a minute.
What?
I don't get you. I mean, first, you hate me. Then, you sleep with me. Then, you want nothing to do with me. Now, you want me again?
What, so you never went out with an actress before?
So, I debated whether to do the first or the last of Dina Meyer's episodes. That line was the one that put this episode over the top.
Yeah.
Because I thought you would enjoy that.
Yeah. Brilliant.
So Kate regrets always going for high status guys instead of ones who are sweet like Joey, and then passes out mid-sentence on his chest. And while we see him arrange her on the couch and put a waste paper basket by her face in case she has to hurl, I hope you, Sarah, knew there would not be barf on camera. I will make you watch Friends. I won't make you watch that.
Thank you very much. I assumed that they were not going to, you know, being a network sitcom that aired at 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
That they were not going to go full chunk. But I was definitely thinking that he should put a trash can because, you know,
mm-hmm.
tequila.
Yeah. Well, and he turns her head too. He knows. That's how you make sure she doesn't choke.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, Joey's euphoric back at Monica's because he and Kate stayed up all night talking and he feels that their relationship's at a new level. But when he gets to the theater that night, he's late to curtain and Lauren's already on stage, but manages to whisper to Joey that Kate got a job in L.A. And Kate herself shows up backstage between scenes and tells him the latest, clip 7.
You still want me for General Hospital?
But what about us?
Last night was wonderful. But I can't stay here just for you.
Well, so... stay for the museums.
General Hospital! It's back! Friends reference form.
Yeah, and stay for the museums. Chef's kiss.
Yes.
Love it.
So Joey begs Kate to stay so he can take her to the airport after the show, but her flight is about to leave. However, he sees that she has stayed in the aisle for the closing scene, and his farewell monologue works on two levels as he delivers it over Lauren's shoulder to Kate. Clip 8.
I gotta say goodbye, and I gotta say it quick, because this is killing me. One thing you gotta know is that I will never forget you. But you got things you have to do now, and so do I. And so, I'm gonna get on this spaceship.
The ladder comes down.
The Christmas lights on it.
Perfect. And I'm going to go to Blargon 7 in search of alternative fuels. But when I return, 200 years from now, you'll be long gone. but I won't have aged at all. So you tell your great, great granddaughter to look me up. Because Adrian, baby, I'm gonna wanna meet her.
Okay, this is the most we've seen of the play so far. Nothing we had seen before ever hinted that Blargon 7 was going to be part of it. So, Sarah, you live in New York. So you have friends in the arts. You live with an actor in your very own home. Tell us your impression of Boxing Day, this play.
I mean, that all of a sudden, a like household ladder with like Christmas fairy lights on it comes down and there's like a meow sound. Like, I've been to a variation on that play hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. Like, this is Fringe, but with no sense of humor.
Yes.
About itself. Usually you're on a bunch of folding chairs and it's not a raked audience. Like, it's, yeah, I mean, you know, we were all in our 20s and trying to support each other. And so, yeah, Blargon 7, excellent, like, excellent work. And, you know, once again, Matt LeBlanc able to, like, it's hard to play an actor who's, like, maybe not a good actor and also is kind of a dumb character. Mm-hmm. Like, this is hard to do. It's, and he does a great job. So, and then he gets on the ladder and like they know exactly how far to push the stupidity of this and no further. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for all of those reasons and also Dina Meyer, this is, you know, eventually you're going to force me to watch all of the Friends run somehow. And I'm not mad about it. Like, they always end up being entertaining in some way. So this was fun. I like this one.
All right. Well, let's do Dina Meyer in review. How did she work for you here?
Perfectly cast, understands how to do this, is good at comedy and doesn't, like, she knows that she's coming into an ensemble show that's extremely successful and is in its third season, and she just finds her slot and does it. And also, you know, she's beautiful and it's completely believable that Joey would be obsessed with her. And she plays drunk well as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, thumbs up.
She has to do a lot of modes in this episode. Like, she's, you know, drunk, as you mentioned, you know, euphorically drunk. You know, she's polite when she's meeting the Friends for like 1 second before Marshall pulls her away. She's sad after the bad reviews come out. She's bereft, you know, when Marshall, she has to reveal that Marshall dumped her, but also like, well, this is what I deserve because I picked a shithead and he acted like a shithead. Like, here we are. Yeah. And then, you know, hopeful for the future. And she does all of it well. It's making it seem like there's a lot more to her part than it is, but she gets a lot to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does.
For an episode that really spans like a day and a half. So we have to close this up by going back to General Hospital. As an expert, what would you like to see Kate Miller do on General Hospital in 1997?
I had sort of fallen out of the plot lines in 1997, so I would sort of have to like retroactively slot her into some 80s WSB thing.
That's fine.
But I think Anna Devane, as played by the great Finola Hughes, stayed on the show and possibly is still on the show. Mm-hmm. And a question mark. She might have left a couple of years ago. Doesn't matter. I think that I would either swap out the woman who played Celia Andrews with Dina Meyer to be Grant Andrews / Grant Putnam, like double face swapping agents. Stricken bride, or that she would be a contact of Anna Devane's that was on for a while. Mm-hmm. And seemed like she was with Duke Lavery, who wants you to leave here now, but actually is a WSB double agent who's like spying on Duke Lavery, you know, laverly. But yeah, she'd be great on any soap.
Yep.
Because she's been great on a soap and she understands. She understands what her job is always.
Yep.
That one. So, yeah.
Agree. We did it.